I was going to speak about statistics. That's the last thing I'm going to say about statistics. Please hold your applause. I am instead going to speak about realistic foreground simulations, and so hopefully that will be of interest. The work I'm going to talk about was done as somewhat part of my thesis and part of a larger project on the CMB at Berkeley by a group of people called WOMBAT, the Wavelength-Oriented Microwave Background Analysis Team, and there's a long list at the bottom of all the wonderful people who helped with at least some aspect of the simulations we did and of the foreground predictions that we did. And, of course, the three of us at the top who really sort of figured everything out and tried to run the show are all here for you to speak to. For those of you who aren't up on your marsupials, this is a wombat. Fine creature, shown here life size. Well, on the projector, life size. Not quite, but good enough. Just a summary of what I'm going to talk about. I'll do the first part quickly so we don't get too sick of foregrounds. Talk very quickly about the galaxy. Talk about extragalactic foregrounds, which as we're now seeing as these instruments go to higher and higher L, the point sources become more important, and the ability to predict, subtract, and then know what kind of errors have been introduced by point sources becomes more and more important. So I'll talk about that at some length. I'll show you the simulations of foregrounds that Wombat made, which includes some pretty pictures, and then talk a bit about our future goals. The way I view all this stuff is if you want to get good science out of the microwave sky, that doesn't consist solely, of course, of the CMB, but also of learning about the other components of microwave emission. And that's for two reasons. One, you want to do the best job you can of getting the actual cosmological information, which requires doing a full subtraction of foreground contamination, and then giving a fair estimate of the systematic errors that have been introduced by your uncertainties in those foregrounds. We are just at the beginning of doing a decent job of that. Now, one of the things that I think is happening is that we've moved through a transition region from COBE, where galactic contamination was a real problem, through sort of degree scale instruments where the foregrounds didn't seem to be that bad, now towards higher L instruments where the foregrounds are again going to be a real problem. And what you see nowadays in the literature is people sort of saying, well, we did some quick foreground checks and things aren't bad. And, well, that's an exaggeration. Really, a lot of the papers recently have not been devoting very much effort to foregrounds analysis. I know in the case of Boomerang and Maxima that such analysis is planned, is going to come out later, but there's already a caveat there that you shouldn't be 100% sure your CMB information until you've done a thorough foregrounds analysis. An example of how most things are going, I think, comes from sort of QMAP, which is to publish a paper, say the foregrounds aren't too bad, see future paper, and then actually come out with that future paper and say, okay, the correction to our published points from before is 3% here and 2% here. At least that tells everyone what you can really say. Now, the data sets we're getting now, we can learn about the foregrounds themselves from. That's where the secondary science comes in. We can learn about galactic structure. We can learn about high redshift galaxies. Learn about the evolution of the cluster abundance. And as we learn more and more about the foregrounds, of course, our models improve and the ability to subtract foregrounds from future data sets improves. So it's really a cycle. If you want to do a good simulation of all the various sources of microwave emission in the sky, there's a lot to choose from. Various kinds of galactic emission, some of which are decently well understood synchrotrons, some of which are still being studied free. Dust is in pretty good control now with the SFD dust map. Spinning dust grains remain a mystery. And there are some point sources, although thankfully they're concentrated on the galactic plane. For extragalactic foregrounds, we have to worry about all sorts of different kinds of galaxies out there. Radio galaxies that may still be bright enough to matter up through 90 gigahertz. Low redshift infrared bright galaxies from IRAS, which are under decent control, but matter down to about 90 gigahertz. These sources seen by SCUBA that you can't find any kind of a catalog of, because we don't know where they are, except in the very small regions that SCUBA has actually observed, they're present are going to be an issue at high frequencies. The SD effect, thankfully, isn't that prevalent, or unfortunately isn't that prevalent, depending on what your primary science is, but it still will come into play. And we have to worry about any kind of inhomogeneous reionization due to things like quasar bubbles. Full simulation of the sky, like the ones we've done, you can in the end add in the CMB anisotropy, which thanks to codes like CMBFast is now an easy thing to simulate. And then if you use HeelPix or something, you can make a full sky map. all along the way, if you want to have a really good estimate of the microwave sky, you should use whatever information is available, and that means spatial templates when possible, either in terms of diffuse emission, like a dust map, or in terms of known locations of point sources. A lot of the foreground analyses out there, and here I mentioned a couple of them, have just used source counts rather than the actual known positions of the sources. And there's obviously a level of information you're losing there. So let me mention a couple of previous foreground models, partially to give you the ability to go look them up if you're interested, and partially to tell you how what we've done is different. The work done by Toflotti et al., this is really in preparation for the HFI instrument of Planck, but they do a full frequency coverage, does a good job of including everything, but only looks at source counts, which, again, doesn't take into account the actual known information about position of sources or their actual numbers. I talked to Toflotti and told him that we thought he was off by a factor of 2 in the counts of radio sources at 90 gigahertz, and he says that that's within their realm of uncertainty. So there's at least a factor of 2 uncertainty in there that isn't always clear from the papers. The simulations of Boucher and Gasper do a good job of including all the different components, but what they do is they fix the spectral behavior so that now if you have a radio source, all radio sources on the sky will go like new to the first power, or actually new typically to the minus 0.5 power. So everything has a known spectral dependence. That's obviously not so realistic, so we tried to add to that a level of realism. And then there's this great paper by Max and collaborators where they have foreground models, and they've done an incredibly thorough job. There's over 500 parameters involved. But even in reality, when you think about the way foregrounds work, they don't go by a number of parameters like a cosmological model. In reality, there's foregrounds in every pixel on the sky with an uncertain amplitude and an uncertain spectral index, so you get many more than even 500 parameters, and of course you don't know how many parameters there are or exactly what they are. And so the realistic foreground subtraction requires something more complex than that. At the same time, if you want a rough estimate of what percentage error foregrounds will cause in cosmological parameter estimation, I think this method wasn't too bad. And they were saying that depending on exactly what happens, it can be as high as 10%, which means that we've got to do a better job if we want to get people to cosmological parameters that have somewhat been promised. Just to remind you, these various foregrounds have different spectral behaviors, which if your instrument has multiple frequencies, is of course the best way to get rid of them. Infrared processes are rising, either the galactic dust or infrared galaxies, or even the SCUBA sources should still be rising. And then galactic radio or extragalactic radio sources will come down like this. And the SD effect, of course, is a decrement here, null at 217 if it's not relativistic temperature, and then an increment later on. So to speak a little bit about extragalactic emission, it's just a list of some of the things that I've worked on. And along with the Toflotti work that I mentioned earlier, this really is sort of what's been done on predictions of source counts and then source locations. You can take the IRAS catalog, extrapolate it. You can take a radio catalog and extrapolate it. And you can try to put limits as well. There also is an ability, based on work that Alex Frigier has pioneered, to really just take the XBAX catalog and predict how bright clusters will be. Now, I'm sure the people who work at individual clusters have worked on that, but if you're actually worried about clusters as a contaminant, particularly for a large angular survey instrument like the MAP satellite, that's a good source of information. And then this is just an example of several different models out there for how these SCUBA-type sources will behave, these high redshift galaxies. Now, we actually went ahead and made full-sky realizations, first of all for predictions, and then later on for the ability to simulate, of each of these individual components. So one thing we did is to add to that catalog of radio sources from Sakazian et al., something from the PMN survey to make our sky coverage uniform. And this is what that looked like. Now, this was a fascinating thing. Turns out this happens because I did integer division in IDL, and so I put all the radio sources at a precise hour multiple in right ascension. Having discovered the cosmic flower, as I call it, I printed out a copy of this and gave it to my girlfriend as a present. You can only get away with that sort of thing if your girlfriend is also a physicist, I found out. But thankfully she is. This is actually what that looks like, and I'll issue a blanket apology now that I'm sure you can't see anything but junk there. There's lots of little sources on here, and people who are interested should come see these overheads in person afterwards. The good news is that once you actually put all the sources on from the Sakazian catalog and add in PMN, there's essentially uniform sky coverage except for the galactic plane, where of course there are problems with seeing the sources and not as many surveys. And we've got basically the about the 4,000 brightest radio sources covered in the catalog, with predictions at all the relevant frequencies. You can do the same thing with IRAS, which I'm sure looks completely indistinguishable from where you sit. Again, look if you're interested. And the pictures on the website are much better. And this is 5,300 brightest sources on the sky with, again, good coverage except in the galactic plane. In the case of IRAS, just a couple regions of the sky that it didn't thoroughly survey.
Yes?
Yes. So what does that mean? That means that that's the level I had to set it at for every source to show up as a dot. If you want to see how bright they really are, you have to either change that scale or actually go look in the ASCII file we offer of how bright they're predicted to be, frequency by frequency. It's a function of frequency. Do you want to know? Oh, sorry. At 100 gigahertz, the IRAS sources are going to add in the order of a few microkelvin. They're not going to be relevant to anything until you get...
That's their R mass.
They add zero to microwave background. Of course, they're rising in spectral index, so that's all coming from very high L, but these IRAS sources aren't going to be important. Radio sources, on the other hand, you can see in here that this scale is up to about 10 microkelvin, and there's a number of orange points, again, probably easy to see by eye. So you're now talking about on the order of 10 microkelvin if you were to just do the whole sky and ignore them. The trick with that, of course, is the brightest sources have maxed out there. So if you actually do the RMS, it'll be dominated by the brightest sources. And what happens is that at 100 gigahertz or 90 gigahertz, if MAP just ignored the radio sources, they'd have a problem. It'd be much worse at... Yeah, so... Right. If you want plots of this kind of thing, I can show you. And the paper by Sarkazian et al. Has those in them. We also did a simulation of the SCUBA sources. To do this properly, and basically the method for getting the source counts and such things was worked on by Douglas and Martin. What we did is to actually make a real sky realization of this. You have two components you have to worry about. First of all, just Poissonian. There's sort of on order 30 relevant sources in each pixel if you're sort of at the map pixelization level. There's going to be some Poissonian fluctuations, especially the brightest ones in the NFS law. And then there's a clustering, which is completely unknown what the clustering of the SCUBA sources will be. We know only a little bit about that. And so therefore, there's a wide uncertainty in just how clustered they'll be in the sky. You have to worry about this because this is sort of every pixel in the sky has some and they're clustered. So it now looks very Gaussian. It looks very much like CMB. It does have a different frequency spectrum and it does have a different C sub L spectrum, but it's not single bright points. So this is a component that's worth looking at. We looked at the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, and intrigued by the concept of the cosmic web, I actually did a simulation of what the filament contribution might look like. I discovered the cosmic pyramid here. Great things need to be simulated data. The toy model here is I took every cluster in the XBAC survey and gave it two filaments extending from it that contained about the same total emission, so at a much lower temperature, but the filaments are much bigger than the clusters. And if two clusters are within 100 megaparsecs of each other, they got a filament joining them, hence these cute geometric structures. You could complain about that, but it turns out to be irrelevant. Notice again, this is a 1 microkelvin scale. And if you put it instead on a scale where things actually are vaguely relevant, a 30 microkelvin scale, then the things that turn out to be dominant are individual clusters with the filaments being essentially unimportant. It's no surprise. It's exactly the same reason it's very hard so far to detect the SC effect from filaments. So they're not going to be a dominant foreground. The clusters themselves aren't that numerous, but again, MAP should take them into account. And the trick, of course, is if your experiment's covering a smaller portion of the sky than MAP, and you happen to have a bright cluster in it, well, you'd like to know that ahead of time, so it's good to check the list that we've posted. So a sense of what we've been able to do with extragalactic sources is to actually show the uncertainties, as well as giving our best guess at everything, to be honest about how uncertain we are, which you'll notice is often a systematic uncertainty, so all we can say is a factor of a few. We figure that when it comes to IRAS sources, we know sort of the overall typical spectrum, good to only a factor of 3 at 90 gigahertz. That's because we're not sure of the average dust emissivity, and these were all taken at 60 to 100 microns. So you're extrapolating by a factor of 30 in frequency. Factor 3 uncertainty in the overall spectrum is not so surprising. Source by source, of course, that spectrum may vary. So by 90 gigahertz, we think there's an uncertainty in the source amplitude of up to a factor of 5. And then locally, in terms of the spectrum, not so much uncertainty, because we think we know roughly what the emissivity is for small frequency differences. We've also put a factor for that as well, and these are all explained in a little more detail on our website. For radio sources, we've got information not just at 1.4 and 4.8 gigahertz, but in making the Circassian et al. Catalog, we scoured the literature and put in all the observations we know of, including a lot of sources that are already observed at 90 gigahertz, some 500 sources that have 90 gigahertz observations in the literature. Then you're not extrapolating much, at least at 90 gigahertz, which is nice. So there's still some uncertainty due to source variability and instrumental errors in what the typical spectrum would be, the source-by-source amplitude or the source-by-source spectrum. And then for Sinyaev-Zoldovich clusters, this is probably a little unfair. It's closer to 1, except in the case of relativistic clusters, the spectrum is well known. We still have some uncertainty in their amplitude, since after all, they were measured using X-ray emissivity, and we're predicting what SE level will correspond to that. And that transition, although understood, has some uncertainty in it. For the SCUBA galaxies, these high redshift infrared sources, of course, we don't know exactly what their spectrum is either, what their typical emissivity is. And really the way to think of them, since they cover every pixel, is that the amplitude depends on just how clustered they are, and there's basically a factor of 10 uncertainty in what the W of theta of these sources might be. They could be as high as Lyman Break galaxies, but those come from a narrow redshift range, so that seems unlikely, but just how much less clustering there is not known. And then there's going to be some uncertainty pixel by pixel, even though each source is a different spectral index, still each pixel will get a different average spectral index by some smaller amount. So we've tried to be honest about all those. You can see the numbers aren't exact, but they give you a rough sense of just how much is known and just how much isn't known. And this is the difference, really, between predictions and simulations. Everything we've done up until now is a prediction, and now we've given an honest assessment of our uncertainties. Then to make a simulation of the foregrounds, you do a realization within all these uncertainties. So each uncertainty is going to be realized source by source or pixel by pixel, and you now see how you rapidly get above 500 parameters. There's a lot of randomness on the sky that you cannot predict a priori, and that you're not going to be able to reconstruct parameter by parameter out of the data. So when all that's done, we offer you some tools for foreground subtraction, which we notice that some of the instrumental teams are making use of, and we hope everyone will at least take a look and decide if they find them helpful. So these can be found on our website. They're called the Microwave Foreground Predictions version 1.0, because we hope to improve them in the future. And of course, one of the ways to improve them is to get feedback from people. If our predictions turn out to be low or high for a certain source or a certain place, we'll try to improve that. For galactic predictions, the biggest improvement in recent years, of course, is the Schlegel-Finkbeiner-Davis dust map, combining Derby and IRS 100 micron. Even since I came out, I've seen some papers that do cross correlations with the IRS 100 micron map, and Doug will be happy to spank people for doing that, because it just doesn't make any sense given the zero point floating that's going on with that. All right, maybe he won't enjoy it, but he'll still spank you. And also, Doug's worked on a D-striped Haslam map. So if you're interested in that, which is a better version for cross-correlating for synchrotron, you should talk to him. In terms of extragalactic sources, what I've been concentrating on, there is now this list of downloadable ASCII files at all of the frequencies that are relevant. We happen to choose the frequencies from MAP or MAXIMA, but they're pretty common frequencies, partially because they correspond to atmospheric windows. So we hope that those are useful for everybody. If somebody wanted an intermediate frequency, that would be pretty easy to run the models for, so they should just talk to me. And it's a pretty large set of extragalactic sources that we've got a handle on, 4,000 radio, 5,000 IRAS, and over 200 clusters. And we do it in honest admission of our uncertainties. So we hope that those data products will be helpful in actually finding foregrounds and then subtracting them from real data sets. So as I said, at that point we can move from prediction to simulation. And the idea that we had a couple years ago was that we think it would be useful to go ahead and make a set of simulations of the entire microwave sky out there, realistic instrument, observing realistic frequencies, and see if people can extract the CMB parameters that went in from the data. So we did this. We put it on the website as the Wombat Challenge and wrote a couple of articles describing how it was made and what was the purpose of it. And there's also a paper that's in preparation that tells you detail by detail how the simulations were put together. One of the things that we're trying to decide is whether to publish the answers in that paper for exactly what cosmology went in, because no one has yet successfully extracted the CMB from here. So it's not yet been proven. Well, that, of course, is the next issue. As far as we know, there are two groups that have at least looked at doing it, and we have a submission from one of them, but it's only sort of a half analysis of the MAXIMA-type simulation maps. nothing as large as the MAP satellite yet. We know that at the time we were talking about doing this, at the Princeton IS meeting, the MAP team, particularly Dave Spergel, said they really loved the idea and they'd definitely do it, but I think they've been busy with a few things. So one of the things we have to say is if anyone is really committed to doing this, we can keep the answer secret, or if people are only comfortable doing this if they can find out before they publish something whether their answers are right or not, then we can go ahead and make our ingredients public first. That may be an aspect. Yes, there was an incentive, and I'd say it's still valid. We offered a case of champagne to the best result and a secret stuffed animal of some form to the group that best analyzed the foregrounds. So those... I'd say that all still stands. All right, so let's go over beer tonight. Lyman will give his entry. Just a quick summary of what you will find on that website are MAP simulations, which are meant to be as close to the MAP satellite as we can get without really having the instrument simulation software. At the right frequencies, the right angular resolution, and then a guess as to the right amount of oversampling in the pixels. And because this last map, to be properly oversampled, has to get so big in terms of the number of pixels, we made a degraded version available just to save your supercomputer a little bit of cycles. That's up there. And I'll show you what they look like. This is the answer for one of them. There's five different simulations of full map data sets, not in time order data or anything, just in the maps. So you don't have to deal with the first nasty part of the problem. There's CMB in there. There are galactic and extragalactic foregrounds. There's even, again, this is hard to see without having it in front of you, a couple of places on here where the Sinyaev-Zaldovich effect actually subtracts from the galaxy. So you get a little negative spot inside the positive galaxy, which should happen, and lots of sources off-plane. And there's this really... This map actually looks right to you because it's a map of the noise. Believe it or not, this map isn't actually uniform in the noise properties. The ecliptic poles get lower noise. It's hard to see, but you can just pick it out with your eye if you've got very good vision. And when it's all put together, you've got a realistic simulation of the microwave sky, in this case at 40 gigahertz. At 22 gigahertz, the galaxy looks worse, and there's even less sense of CMB in here. And the good news is that when you look at the 90 gigahertz version of this, the galaxy seems to shrink, and since the mean has been set to zero, the shrinkage of the galaxy allows the CMB to sort of come up and be red and blue in here, and you do see sort of Kobe-sized hot and cold spots. And this is actually made using a Wiener-filtered version of the Kobe map, so the hot and cold spots correspond to the same ones you see in Kobe. That's worth nothing but a sanity check, because of course we want to look at things much smaller than that. Remember, the resolution of these things has to be degraded to print out and on the pixelization scheme that your printer can handle, or my printer can handle. So there's really a lot of information in there, and you can, in theory, extract however many acoustic peaks might be in the cosmological models. We also did a set of the quote-unquote maxima maps. These were designed to be about the same size coverage of the recent maxima simulation, 10 by 10 degrees. They do contain only Gaussian noise, so they are a really nice idealization of how a balloon experiment works, because in a real-world balloon experiment, you have the correlated noise. We did not include that, although if someone's interested in trying that, there are ways to do it. They cover the three frequencies that are sort of common. And what we did here is like an added bonus was to include uncertainty in the beam size, which is something that too often hasn't been accounted for, although people, of course, now are doing it in their data analysis. And so all we say is that you know what the expected full width half max is after your calibration, but there's really an uncertainty of one arc minute. And of course, these three beams, although you might have designed them to be the same, don't turn out to be precisely the same at every frequency. Good. So, about how large is it? So, they're twice as good as they expected when we asked them how good they expected to be. Right. So this is... So the good news is that the number Adrian's quoting is consistent with their calibration uncertainty, and this would be too high.
No. so. It's pretty clear.
Yeah.
You have to be a little careful because there's an anti-correlation that comes in at IL and things of how you make the genes in the calibration, so you don't get the full effect. At intermediate cells, you get the full effect. Of not going to solid.
So it sounds to me like we overestimated the eventual error bar, but underestimated again the true instrumental difficulties of a real-world observation data set, which is no surprise. Go ahead. I want to know about all that. Absolutely. And he wants to know too. Okay. So I put up here an example of one of our quote-unquote Maxima simulations. This is the one that's dearest to my heart because from sheer Gaussian random errors on purpose in the simulation, it has a really bright point source, brighter than anyone seen in the real Maxima data set and brighter than anyone seen in our other four Maxima simulations. Such things can happen. And you do see CMB or CMB-like fluctuations in here as well as pixel-by-pixel instrument noise. And we actually realized these on a full sphere and then projected them onto a 10-by-10 degree map. So that's not going to be precisely the same as the true sky. It's therefore designed to be sort of acceptable for FFT-type techniques. And if you want to get things to the 1% level precision, you're going to have to think about the difference between a flat plane and the full sky. But these data sets are designed to not need the supercomputer, so we're hoping that no one's going to worry about those issues on these. I would maintain that the simulations I've just showed you are the most realistic ones that have been made, albeit I'm sure the MAP team at this point has done some pretty good simulations. We haven't seen them. They're going to be doing internal work, I'm sure, at this point, for following several reasons. We've gone ahead and used the spatial template information, both for diffuse emission and for the individual sources, and put the known bright sources, radio, IRAS, and Sinyavs-Aldovich clusters, at their proper place in the sky. So you can go in and find those where you expect them to be, just as much as in real life you can find bright sources roughly where you expect them to be. For dimmer sources, that won't always work, and that's an example, for instance, with the SCUBA sources we have. Particularly for a full sky experiment like the MAP satellite, this is what will happen. Most of the sources that bother you are bright ones, and you know a priori where to look for them. We've gone ahead and included realistic simulations of things like these SCUBA galaxies, using just the number counts and some realistic uncertainty in what their spectra will be. For diffuse emission, we've used the best existing galactic dust map, and we've come out used Doug Finkbinder's extrapolation method using the FIRAS data. And then, lastly, for the galaxy, we go ahead and use this improved version of the Haslam map that's destriped, and as well as determine the synchrotron emission index by comparing maps at 1.4 and 2.3 gigahertz. Synchrotron's not a really dominant foreground, but you might as well handle it as best you can. And some people before have actually tried to add a Gaussian simulation of smaller scale structure to the synchrotron maps, which, because the phases are so clearly correlated in those maps, doesn't make any sense, and so we avoided doing that. I'll buy you that beer later. Who are you going to split it with? All right, so what are our future goals? Well, we'd like to expand our simulation capabilities, particularly to go ahead and start going up to Planck resolution. We do have a couple years to work on that. And we'd also like to, of course, do some interferometer simulations, which, unfortunately, we don't so far have the knowledge to do, but I'm talking to the interferometer people. You could basically take the realized patch of sky and go ahead and observe it like an interferometer and make a simulated interferometer data set. That might be valuable. So if people are interested, please talk to us. We'd like to use actual data and feedback from the instrumental teams that look at our predictions and say, oh, you guys are mostly right, but here's the problem. Here's where you're wrong. To go and improve our models and to reduce the uncertainties. See, a lot of those uncertainties are very big right in this low foreground regime between 90 and 150 gigahertz. Not surprising. Right where the foregrounds are dimmest is where you want to observe the CMB. But you also know the least about the foregrounds because they're dim there. And so any feedback we get is helpful for reducing the uncertainties. And we'd go ahead and like to move on and make predictions for polarization and do some simulations. Right now it's an interesting issue just how bad foregrounds will be for polarization. There are two papers in the literature, one of which says that synchrotron is irrelevant for foreground contamination of polarization experiments, and one of which says that it's really important. So it's clear to me that that issue needs to be looked at in more detail. And I wanted to sort of finish off by being perhaps a bit provocative and just asking for some feedback from the audience. You know, we've got to decide as we write up the final paper on how all these simulations were made, as I said, whether we're going to make the inputs of all the simulations, cosmological and foreground model parameters, public, or maybe perhaps just reveal that for some of the simulations, leave some secrets so you can do a blind test of methods, or maybe in fact keep them all in the dark. And I can make an opinion, but I wanted some feedback. So I figured, you know, it being the campaign season and all, we should put this to a vote. Phil, are you voting already, or? All right, let's pretend that that's a variation of the answer some. But I like the idea. That's sort of possible. So how many people would vote for all? Does anyone want us to make all the input parameters public? One person. Two. How many vote for some?
If people don't want to look, then they don't look.
Isn't it easy to simulate again? I mean, there are, let me say it.
You mean to make some more? Right.
An absolutely finite number of groups are measured on one or two fingers who are going to actually do this. So,
good. Good. Right. And does anyone vote for none? All right. So, I think, He's from Chicago. So, look, I think Dick's comment is really fair. I mean, the trick is we can always do more simulations later on that aren't known if people really do want to do a blind survey. Since the blind study doesn't seem to be getting a lot of enthusiasm, we might as well go ahead and make it public and let people test. But thanks for your help, Doug. All right, so another issue I wanted to take a sort of get the pulse of the nation on was, you know, if I'd been the referee for the recent Boomerang papers, I would have said that if you want to publish data points, you should have to publish the window functions along with them. Now, that's just my personal opinion, but I was thinking we could ask the audience if Boomerang and Maxima should be required to, voluntarily or not, release the window functions for their published data points. Now, this is a step short of releasing a full data set, which I understand people want to do further analysis on before it's public. But if you actually print in a paper, here are our data points, plus or minus, and here's the range of L, in order for people to really know what that means, you need to have the window function. But that might just be my take on it. So, well, on a certain set of data points. The shape? No. It's I mean, right now, if I want to go and see if a particular model is a good fit or not to the data, I can get a rough sense from just pretending those are data points. I can get a better sense from sort of fitting a Gaussian window function through them. But all I know is that the bins have in fact been orthogonalized, so there's some little contribution from other Ls, but I don't know what it is. And I don't know precisely how correlated they are. So I can't do that fit exactly. So what would you do? You just do a flat response in those bins and then pretend they're uncorrelated? So is everyone happy with that? Is that all we want out of the instrumental teams ever? So if they were to tell us what the covariance matrix of the points is, sure.
Having a general vote on is actually an internal vote which is occurring within the collaboration.
Fine. What's Maxima going to do? I'll show you what else I was going to say. The next thing relates, which is that then for people who don't have access to the full data sets, is it perfectly fine, only roughly correct, or useless to do fits for cosmological parameters? And then the last question was...
Thank you.
All right.
So one thing that I thought was somewhat missing was, so Wombat has simulated, but presumably you have a path that you think people should be using in order to analyze, I mean, not just putting it as a path
sure.
to everybody else.
Sure.
But now, one of them is obviously you make use of whatever templates are available.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, what should one do? That's the first point. Second point is, how is one going to actually determine the errors and the statistical distribution of the errors for a foreground subtracted thing?
Right. So I've thought about that. Nick is correct that you can't work many full nights on these simulations without thinking about how you do the analysis yourself and what's the best way to do it. It's certainly not clear what the best way to do it is. And one of the reasons we're making these things publicly available is we want a number of different methods to be tried on them rather than just trying every method ourselves. I think there's a... Well, you've got that so well covered, Steve, that... I did, one of the chapters of my thesis is actually a proposal for a new foreground subtraction method that would work completely in pixel space and then try to keep account of what the system of what the errors are introduced and their correlations. Because, of course, one of the problems is you end up with essentially correlated noise that comes from the imperfect subtraction of foregrounds that have spatial correlations across the sky. And so one of the things I've been working on is updating that, and that's actually one of the things I'm going to be working on while I'm here. So I guess without giving a short answer to your question, anybody who's really interested in that, I'd invite to talk to me while I'm here for the next couple weeks.
Because presumably you're going to assume that it's a Gaussian error described by a covariance filter.
That's what I've done so far. Well, that's true. Usually the problem is when you know it's not perfectly Gaussian, you don't know exactly what it is. So...
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, you know, at the level of... The level of precision that, let's put math aside for a second.
Sure.
The precision that Planck is supposed to get to, right? The BMW experiment. Will it be realizable based upon foreground subtraction and the fact that that's going to introduce a lot of presumed non-Gaussian as a result of that attempt to do the subtraction that's going to be incomplete?
Mm-hmm. Well, non-Gaussianness is kind of funny because, of course, every distribution has a second moment. So you're going to introduce an error into the second moment, and you're going to introduce further moments from the non-Gaussianness. So at some level, what's happening is incomplete foreground subtraction is going to affect your power spectrum and affect your checks for Gaussianity in the distribution of the pixel temperatures. So you'd want to look at both of those, and I think what you're saying is you'd want to look at them in a coherent way.
A math is more than just the math.
Right.
Statistics.
Right. And those will be affected.
The math get affected. The question is there any mechanism to try and take that into account? The answer is, of course, no. And what is the likely scenario, really?
Oh, I understand.
And the likely scenario is that we are going to be describing the attempted extractions in terms of the math and I think this is right, the math and the distribution which we're going to approximate by a Gaussian.
It depends for what percent, but it's something we haven't looked at yet and need to. Yeah, no, that's a fair point.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing, just as a general comment, the thing that is has been banged home, and we knew that the day was coming, statistical errors of parameters, of power spectrum, are ceasing to become an issue.
Right. Right.
You know, we can get fine precision on things that are off because it's systematic. Parameters are just everything is going to come down to systematic. And if we've got something, and we know that this is happening from all of the simple stuff that's been done, is that it can shift you to an exquisitely determined set of results that you're wrong.
Right. I would think that you've done a really good job of your foreground subtraction if at the end of the day you're within a factor of three of what the Fisher matrix would say, i.e. Fisher matrix not accounting for fancy non-Gaussian foreground problems. That you're always going to have bigger systematics than your statistical errors I think so far what I can envision, you're talking of order unity, but probably a factor of three or more worse.
Well, I don't know. Is Roy here? There was the sort of quote-unquote Chicago method where
mm-hmm.
increasing the variance associated with the, you know, when they were doing pixel-to-pixel subtraction, trying to do best fit. That's one strategy that I think the particular top hat simulation. So, I mean, this is really no trivial issue.
Sure.
I have no idea how the field is going to handle it.
And at some level, that's one of the reasons we've made this all public, because we don't expect to answer every one of those questions ourselves. It's an issue that I think is worth a lot of people taking a look at. Anybody else? Okay.